heterosexual. Tienes trucos, son casi perfectos. No quiero ser objeto sexual. Me calientas, después te vas.
WRCT Pittsburgh. We're always here for you.
Thank you. Varsity Insane from Way Out. Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, you may remember the testimony, former Starbucks CEO Howard Schultz pouting to a Senate hearing on the company's union busting, in which he was referred to as a billionaire, that using that moniker constantly is unfair. Quote, "Yes, I have billions of dollars. I earned it. No one gave it to me. And I've shared it constantly with the people of Starbucks," close quote. The delusion that a billionaire earned every penny of it and that it is shared equitably with workers might be special to billionaires, but the broader notion that the government only helps some people and other people do it on their own is conveyed throughout corporate media's narrative. Even as it is corrosive to an understanding of democracy, much less the fight for it. The increasing influence of not merely the rich, but the super rich on the politics and policy we all have to live with is an urgent story, if not a new one. Yet somehow elite news media seem less and less interested in it. We'll talk with David Cass, Executive Director of the Americans for Tax Fairness campaign, about all of that on today's show. That's coming up, but first a look back at some recent press. When Donald Trump ordered an unprecedented freeze on all federal grants and loans, a few news outlets responded with some degree of alarm and scrutiny. Politico's playbook went with Trump's massive power grab, and a headline over a column in New York Magazine read, "Trump's blatantly illegal funding freeze causes nationwide chaos." As Julie Holler writes for Fair.org, the order, since rescinded, was both sweeping and confusingly worded in its call for a halt to disbursement of federal funds that Congress had already authorized. The New York Times pointed out it would appear to include hundreds of billions of dollars in grants to state, local, and tribal governments, disaster relief aid, education and transportation funding, loans to small businesses. Medicaid, which is distributed through the states, also seemed to be frozen. Politico described the first big question as, "Is this legal?" And the answer provided by most legal scholars was, "Absolutely not." As Julie Holler writes for Fair.org, Trump has long declared his interest in impoundment or the executive's ability to cancel funding that Congress has approved. Presidents have done it on occasion, but Richard Nixon pushed it hard, attempting to cancel billions in federal funding, leading Congress to respond by passing the Impoundment Control Act in 1974, which requires congressional permission for presidents to impound funds. In other words, there's been a clear law on the books for over 50 years that expressly prohibits what Trump was attempting here. But the multi-billionaire-owned Washington Post suggested a different take. The paper's headline and lead focused on the confusion in Washington. The first attempt to make meaning of the order came in the eighth paragraph. Quote, "The feared disruption highlighted the extent of the new Trump administration's determination to target long-standing functions of the federal government," close quote. The president tried to usurp Congress's power of the purse by fiat, and the Beltway paper's takeaway was that this highlights the administration's determination not to shred U.S. democracy, but to target long-standing functions of the federal government. The paper would have you confused on the question of legality. quote, the order's legality may be contested, but the president is generally allowed under the law to defer spending for a period of time if certain conditions are met, according to budget experts, close quote. If you feel like suggesting that they not downplay illegal actions just because they are committed by a president that their owner is currying favor with, you can write to the Washington Post at letters@washpost.com or via bluesky@washingtonpost.com. UN analysis of verified deaths in Gaza during a five-month period confirmed that of those who died, 44% were children. Most often, those children were 5 to 9-year-olds, 80% of them killed in their own homes. 20,000 children are still missing, under the rubble or dumped in mass graves. Writing for The Guardian, Nesreen Malik reminds us that the deaths of these children is the most unassailable proof of the injustice of this war, how it was conducted, accepted, and supported. And she cautions that our turning away risks extending indifference to the children who survived, the almost 40,000 orphans, the thousands of amputees, the hundreds of thousands who are displaced and whose schools have been destroyed, and the complete psychological destruction suffered by all children who have lived through the war. Simply compiling numbers or even lists of names without recognition and eulogy, she says, implies that, quote, the killing of children is an industrial byproduct. It is not, close quote. It was to talk about these things that Palestinian-American journalist Ali Abu Nima was traveling to Switzerland last week, where he was questioned by police for an hour at the Zurich airport and then arrested by plainclothes officers who forced him into an unmarked vehicle. Abu Nima spent 2 nights in jail, where he was denied access to his lawyer and his family, and then deported, driven to the airport handcuffed in a small metal cage in a windowless van. As the group Swiss Action for Human Rights says, no valid legal basis was given for this abduction, arbitrary detention, and deportation. In Berlin, we hear that security forces are investigating the group behind images projected onto the Tesla factory, showing Elon Musk doing his Nazi salute, or as Deutsche Welle put it, apparently performing a Nazi-style salute at Trump's inauguration. German authorities say, evidently with straight faces, that the activism may have breached laws on the use of symbols linked to illegal organizations. Meanwhile, stateside, Milwaukee meteorologist Sam Coffel was fired abruptly after commenting negatively on her private Instagram page on Musk's Nazi salute. The nation's sports editor Dave Zirin wrote up the case, noting that a spokesperson for Milwaukee's CBS 58, Molly Kelly, responded to his query, confirming that Coffel is no longer with the station, but then, as spokesperson, insisted that he not use her name in his story. An outlandish request, Zirin notes, that can only be interpreted as an act of shame or fear. What did Coffel do, after all, except open a window, stick her hand out, and tell us it was raining? Here's a headline from NBC News. Trump immigration raids snag U.S. citizens, including Native Americans, raising racial profiling fears. The subhead explains that, quote, a U.S. veteran and Navajo residents have been asked for identification. Critics are complaining of racial profiling as raids and deportations increase, close quote. This language is corporate media cowardice 101. Nothing is really happening. It's just raising fears of it potentially happening, or critics are complaining that it's happening. Reporters Suzanne Gamboa and Nicole Acevedo actually report that, quote, those who are getting caught in immigrations and customs enforcement raids are being targeted because of their race or skin color, according to witnesses, close quote. That's witnesses, not critics or complainers. But editors didn't see fit to get that sense of things in the headlines. And finally, same cowardice, different flavor. Reporting how Trump is firing Democratic members of two independent federal commissions, the EEOC and the NLRB, a move described graciously as breaking with precedent. The Washington Post showed how basic tenets of journalism, like rules around granting anonymity, are just so tired. Quote, these were far-left appointees with radical records of upending long-standing labor law, and they have no place as senior appointees in the Trump administration, which was given a mandate by the American people to undo the radical policies they created, a White House official said, speaking on the condition of anonymity under ground rules set by the administration. Close quote. So you understand. You can say, well, if you're a Trump official, you can say any wackadoodle thing you want, and you don't even have to stand behind it. A major daily will feed it to its readers as newsworthy, no matter what. Those, evidently, are the ground rules. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. In October of last year, our guest's organization reported that 150 billionaire families had broken the record for billionaire campaign spending, putting some $1.9 billion in the coffers of presidential and congressional candidates, with the 10 biggest billionaire family contributors providing almost half of that total. This dystopian situation is an indication not just of the spiraling power and wealth of the super rich, but of the relative weakness of the forces set up to countervail that power. David Cass is Executive Director of Americans for Tax Fairness. He joins us now by phone. Welcome to Counterspin, David Cass.
Well, thank you so much. I'm really glad to be here.
Well, tell us a little bit more about what you found in this research on billionaire clan, as you call it, spending on the 2024 elections. It was an unprecedented amount of money, yes?
It really is. So we did an analysis of how much billionaire families gave in political contributions to the election. And we found that $1.9 billion had been given in this cycle. And that is really just a shocking amount of money. It is unprecedented. It is a record amount. And, you know, we see the impact of that and just the inauguration. I mean, I think that picture where you had a number of these billionaires in front of the cabinet, you had Musk and Bezos and these other folks who made massive contributions to the campaign, and now that they're enjoying the fruits of that, which is, you know, really building this incredible amount of influence in this new administration.
Well, we're going to talk about that influence and that impact, but just some details. You know, first of all, this billionaire spending, it's very concentrated. It's like a relatively small group of super wealthy folks we're talking about, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there are 800 billionaires in the country, and this is, we say that, you know, 150 billionaire families. So it's really, and really just a handful of folks gave an enormous amount of that money. So it really is incredibly concentrated.
Right. And it seems worth saying that this isn't, I don't know why I need to say this, but it isn't families, you know, digging deep to show support for candidates they believe in and putting all their resources towards them. You know, the numbers are huge, but for these people, it's like a lunch tab.
It really is. I mean, it'd be like you and I maybe getting something at Starbucks. And, you know, we found that, you know, the amount of the $1.9 billion, it's $700 million more than we found in the entire 2020 campaign. So the escalation of the money is, you know, the amount of money the billionaires are giving is going dramatically up.
It's not just that the numbers are bigger because they're richer. It does represent an intensified focus on campaign spending from these billionaires.
That's true, but they also are significantly richer, too. I mean, they really have even more money. I mean, right. You know, that total billionaire wealth has surged by $3.8 trillion since the passage of the Trump tax law in 2017. and even it surged even since the election. So they do have an incredible amount of money, and that money keeps going up.
Well, it's all intertwined, all of these things. But again, if the question is the super wealthy's ability to buy power, well, then the corollary question is, why can't we stop what we see happening? So I guess I would ask, why legally are we where we are right now?
No, that's a great question. And the Supreme Court, unfortunately, in the Citizens United case, said that the people could spend an unlimited amount of money as long as it wasn't, did they say, coordinated with the candidates. So that just opened the floodgates. And we've really seen this incredible flow of billionaire money, of corporate money into campaigns because of it. And I think the solution there is to make sure that we change Citizens United, that there needs to be a constitutional amendment to really roll that back so that we can make sure that the richer you are, the bigger your voice is. That's not democracy.
And, you know, lawmakers will always say, oh, well, yeah, they gave me millions of dollars, but I still just vote the way I want to vote anyway. And I think a lot of folks buy that narrative, unfortunately. But appearance of conflict of interest is itself a conflict of interest, isn't it? I mean, there's a reason to study these relationships, even as lawmakers are saying, oh, I don't care who gives me money. I just vote what's in my heart.
Well, I wish it were true that everyone was so pure and did that. But, you know, that's just, you know, that's not the case, right? I mean, if you're getting a huge amount of money from somebody, they're going to have power over you. That is just the facts. And, you know, somebody like Elon Musk, who gave more than $250 million to Donald Trump in this past presidential election, you can see what that bought him, right? I mean, from his point of view, he's the world's richest man, and that's a good investment. He's buying access because he has lots of government contracts, and this protects his interests at the expense of, everyday Americans.
Well, I guess I would lift up here that, I mean, maybe people have assumed it, but still your research bore it out that the majority of this billionaire spending went to Republicans and to Trump. We should just point that out.
That is right.
Well, Americans for Tax Fairness follows the money to its impacts. You know, it's already evident and it's easily foreseeable impacts on public policy. So let's move you on to what fallout can we expect to see, you know, with not just the billionaire campaign spending, but then I know you've also worked on the billionaires now in and around the White House. They feel they're buying something. So what can we regular folks expect?
Well, I think what we can expect is that these billionaires who are going to be having enormous influence are going to be enriching themselves and making decisions that benefit the wealthiest people. You know, we did an analysis that looked at the Trump nominees and people who are worth a billion or more, and you know that the average worth of the Trump proposed economic policy aides is over $500 million, so $500 million. I mean, the guy who proposed for the Commerce Secretary, Howard Lutnick, is worth $2 billion. The guy who's the Treasury Secretary is worth $1 billion. You know, you just have to ask yourself, are people who are that wealthy, are they going to really understand the everyday needs of that firefighter, of that single mom, of that teacher, of that plumber? You know, it's just such a rarefied, extraordinary wealth. And that they're not going to understand the needs of everyday people, and that they may have their own conflicts of interest. I mean, you know, for example, Lutnick, who's the proposed Commerce Secretary, I mean, you know, he has interest in cryptocurrency. Is he going to be able to promote his private business interests, or what's really best for the American people? And I think we see these conflicts up and down the line of these people.
Well, in terms of media, in terms of news media, it's very rankling to me how, you know, if the story is something like retail theft, we get alarm and outrage. Folks boosting baby formula from the CVS is a public concern, you know, and it's maybe the reason that things cost so much. But then a story will blandly note that billionaires or billionaire corporations are getting, quote, favorable tax policy, you know, close quote, as though there were no human harm in that, as though that were the natural order. Where do you see the role of journalism? Are there things that you would like to see more or less of in terms of reporting around this set of issues?
Absolutely. You know, I think the media really has a responsibility to help tie these pieces together. So what we see is, you know, the Republicans are proposing these massive cuts, trillions of dollars in cuts in programs that families count on, you know, healthcare, education, housing. So taking money really out of the pockets of families to give huge tax cuts to the very wealthy. So giving millions to people who have billions. And I think the media really has a responsibility to make sure that people understand that this isn't just these cuts to get government more efficient. Right. I mean, that's, of course, what they say. The reality is that they're cutting these programs to pay for tax cuts for billionaires. So I think that narrative is really important. And I think the other thing is, you know, there was a study done by the Center for American Progress that showed that 57% of the growth in the federal debt this century is due to the Trump and then the Bush tax cuts passed by Republican Congresses. So there's this narrative that somehow spending by Democrats was out of control. Well, the truth is that the majority of the debt in this century is due to Trump and Bush tax cuts, which overwhelmingly benefit the rich. So what's driving our debt is tax cuts for the very rich. That's really the problem. And then now they're trying to make cuts to pay for this. It is, you know, if it weren't true, it would almost be humorous.
Right. Right. And, you know, I wish the storyline weren't so simplistic, but we sometimes see elite news media present campaign finance reform or regulation or even just fair tax policies the same way that billionaires do. It's kind of like it's punishment for people who worked really hard, you guys, you know, and it's just such a silly storyline. And I feel like the fact that so many people are walking around thinking that the government only helps some people and other people do it all on their own, you know, that's like a failure of news media that also lets down public understanding and that leads to inadequate public policy.
Well, I think that's exactly right. And the truth is, and again, what the facts are, is that there are two tax codes. There's one for workers. You know, if you're that firefighter, if you're that teacher, you get a paycheck every 2 weeks and you pay taxes on it. But if you're a billionaire, if you're super wealthy, basically you cannot pay taxes on almost any of this because you're getting so much of your stuff is really in these investments and stocks and things, which if you don't sell them can never be taxed. And that's why, you know, the White House did a study showing that the wealthiest 400 billionaire families paid an average of 8.2% of their income when you include their wealth that goes largely untaxed. But average Americans, they pay 13%, so close to double the rate of America's 400 wealthiest families. So that's the real problem here, is that workers pay taxes every 2 weeks and billionaires can basically never pay taxes. And that's crazy. I mean, for example, if you paid a single penny in taxes this year, you paid more than Elon Musk did in 2018.
Right.
Or that Jeff Bezos did in 2007 or 2011. So that's a crazy system that we really have to fix.
Well, and let's talk about fixing it. And, you know, I mean, I think it's been made clear enough to listeners that your concern about billionaire campaign spending isn't just, you know, billionaires spend a lot of money. It's that they are drowning out the voices and concerns of ordinary Americans. And that's the point. If we have so-called a representative democracy, then this is a problem. So let me ask you, what can we do to change things?
Well, I think there's a number of things. You know, obviously people need to share their concerns with their representatives and to talk about that we shouldn't be cutting key programs that families rely on to pay for tax cuts for the wealthy. So, you know, right now the Republicans are trying to pass this big tax bill, and, you know, they're meeting at one of Trump's fancy resorts in Florida to talk about what they're going to do. So this thing is coming. We know it's coming, and we really need to talk about that. They're going to spend $4 trillion for tax cuts that overwhelmingly benefit the rich. And that is just crazy. That is really crazy.
Yeah. And are there policies? I mean, it seems like folks are saying, why can't we bring back the world before Citizens United? But maybe we just need a whole new vision. Is there anything in the works legislatively or policy-wise apart from vigilance and reporting that we can look to support?
Well, you know, there are really great things that we can do to make sure that your average family is treated fairly. So, I mean, the first thing is to let these Trump tax cuts expire for people who are wealthy, right? I mean, just let the stuff go. You know, they passed from 2017, and for the wealthy, they shouldn't get any more tax cuts. And then there's lots of other things that we can do. You know, the President Biden and also the top Democrat on the Finance Committee, Ron Wyden, had these proposals to make sure that we were taxing billionaires so that their wealth, just, you know, like when you pay every 2 weeks, you pay taxes on your paycheck, that they would have to pay taxes on their wealth. And I think that would be a very important change to make sure that we had a much more fair tax system. And, you know, I think the other part of this is we've talked about, but, you know, it is just so undemocratic to have this extreme wealth gap where billionaires can use this wealth to be able to, you know, make a much, much louder voice than your average American. So those are some of the things. I think, you know, there are things we can do. We've got to stop this bill from passing. People thought when Trump came into office in 2017 that the ACA, you know, the Obamacare, was going to be gone, that Republicans would get rid of it. And they didn't. They weren't able to. They tried. But because there was so much backlash, because so many people protested, they lost. And this is an uphill battle, but, you know, we really have to work and organize and fight to show that more tax cuts for the wealthy coming out of the pockets of families is the wrong approach.
All right, then we'll end on that note. We've been speaking with David Kass from Americans for Tax Fairness. Their work is online at americansfortaxfairness.org. Thank you so much, David Kass, for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you so much. It was great talking to you.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin. To Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, among many other things, 2024 was a series of reminders that corporate news media, tasked primarily with enriching the rich and shoring up entrenched institutions, will not, today or ever, do the liberatory, illuminating work of independent reporting that boldly speaks truth to power, that stands up for the societally voiceless, that provides space for the debates and discussions we need to move society forward, for those of us that believe that U.S. society needs to change. New calendar years are symbolic, sure, but they can also offer a metaphorical fresh start. Why not see 2025 as a much-needed opportunity to acknowledge, support, create, and grow independent journalism. We'll talk about that today with two people who are and have been doing not just critical dissident.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
China's running the Panama Canal. That was not given to China, that was given to Panama foolishly. But they violated the agreement and we're going to take it back or something very powerful is going to happen.
President Trump has reiterated his threat to retake the Panama Canal after Marco Rubio visited Panama on his first foreign trip as Secretary of State. We'll go to Panama and to Guatemala, where Rubio will be today. On Monday, Rubio met with El Salvador's authoritarian leader, who's offering to jail U.S. citizens for a fee and accept deportees from any country. We'll also look at Trump's plan to house as many as 30,000 immigrants at Guantanamo, the U.S. Navy base in Cuba. Then to Trump's threats to deport pro-Palestinian student protesters. In a recent executive order, Trump urged schools to, quote, monitor and report activities by alien students, unquote. We'll speak to a Cornell University graduate student who faced deportation last year after taking part in Gaza's solidarity protests.
My university, Cornell, was presented with a crossroads, and they failed with their attempts to see me deported. Now they have been presented with another crossroad. Will they stand by their students? As we have seen the executive orders rolling in, targeting pro-Palestinian protesters, or will they fail again? We're still waiting to see.
We'll also speak to an Israeli reporter from Haaretz. His new article, "We Will Find You and We Will Deport You: Why Trump's Executive Order on Anti-Semitism is So Dangerous." All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. China's announced retaliatory tariffs on U.S. goods after President Trump initiated a trade war by imposing an additional 10% tariff on all Chinese products. China's finance ministry said it would levy 15% tariffs on U.S. coal and liquefied natural gas and 10% on crude oil, farm equipment, and some U.S.-made vehicles. China's also imposing new export controls on certain minerals, including rare earth elements critical to the electronics industry. This comes after Trump said he would delay plans by at least a month to impose tariffs of 25% on Canada and Mexico. Trump's reversal came after the Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau promised to take steps to crack down on fentanyl smuggling at the U.S. border, even though Canada contributes less than 1% of fentanyl consumed illegally in the U.S. And Mexican President Claudia Sheinbaum said Trump called off the tariffs after she agreed to send 10,000 troops to the border.
He asked me how long I wanted to pause tariffs. I said forever. He told me, how much time? I told him a month. I'm sure that during this month, we'll be able to deliver good results for his people and the people of Mexico.
President Sheinbaum said that under the deal, the U.S. pledged to slow the illegal trafficking of weapons to Mexico, though Trump's account of the agreement on Truth Social made no mention of that commitment. Secretary of State Marco Rubio's named Trump ally and State Department official Pete Maracco as acting administrator of the U.S. Agency for International Development, that's USAID, after the Trump administration placed staff members on leave and took the agency's website and social media accounts offline. NBC reports under the first Trump administration, Maracco's efforts to consolidate power and slash funding drove officials to write a dissent memo that ultimately pushed him out of office. Maracco was also reportedly among the insurrectionists who attacked the U.S. Capitol January 6, 2021. On Monday, a group of House and Senate Democrats rallied outside USAID's shuttered headquarters in Washington, D.C.